dollars, perhaps enforceable like a Security Council resolution would be. So that's where the council is right now.
And Phyllis, so if you could explain that, because normally a General Assembly vote is not legally binding in the way that a Security Council right. vote is, which is why there's so much emphasis on what the Security Council does.
The particularity here, Nermeen, is that when the U.S. or any other of the five permanent members of the council actually uses a veto, a new regulation at the U.N. that was passed a couple of years ago requires that the General Assembly then meet within 10 days to take up that same issue. You know, ordinarily, this is very closely held. The Security Council deals with threats to peace and security around the world. The General Assembly can deal with everything else. But when one of the five permanent members, in this case, of course, the United States, uses its veto on an issue of peace and security, under those conditions, the General Assembly is required to hold an emergency session, and it's held under what's known in the UN as the Uniting for Peace precedent. This was something the UN was forced to accept back in 1951 at the instigation, ironically, of the United States. It's how the U.S. got the United Nations to endorse its war in Korea. And under those conditions, the decisions made by the General Assembly, which officially are considered non-binding, not enforceable, take on additional power because it's derivative of United Nations Security Council power. So the decisions are uncertain whether it's really enforceable, but it's a much stronger resolution in the General Assembly if it follows a veto in the Security Council. That's one of the big reasons why the United States does not like to use its veto if it can avoid it. The other reason, of course, is that it shows the world just how isolated the United States now is. The U.S. and Israel stand alone. The vote in the General Assembly on a very similar resolution was 153 countries out of 193 who voted yes, and only 10 countries, including the U.S. and Israel, voted no. And under those circumstances, it really demonstrates the isolation of the U.S., and that's not something that the Biden administration is eager to be showing up again.
Well, if you could say, Phyllis, I mean, talk about the significance of U.S. support. Explain why it's so strident, despite what's happening in Gaza. And also the fact that when Biden did lightly criticize Israel for its indiscriminate bombardment, saying that it was losing international support, the Israeli foreign minister very quickly said that Israel would continue, quote, with or without international support. Your response to that, I mean, is that accurate, you think?
Right. Well, I think what is true is that the United States has made a number of polite requests of the Israeli government. They have said, please stop killing so many people. What you're doing is okay. Using massive bombardment is okay. But try and pull back a little bit, maybe change the tactics of the ground invasion so that you're not killing quite so many civilians. It doesn't look good. But there are no consequences when the Israeli response, as you just said from Prime Minister Netanyahu or others, is simply, no, we're going to continue what we're doing. There's no way that Israel feels compelled to respond to that until the requests become requirements. And the requirements come with conditions that make a difference. So that when the United States says, you've got to stop bombing Gaza, you're killing civilians and it's illegal under international law, you've got to stop. And Israel says, nope, we're going to continue, then the next sentence out of the mouth of President Biden or Secretary of State Blinken or whoever is relaying that message is, okay, then you know those billions of dollars we send to your military every year? You can kiss that goodbye. And you know how we've been protecting you at the International Criminal Court so you're never held accountable for war crimes? We're not doing that anymore. So those are the kinds of things that will begin to have a real impact on Israel. As long as the Israelis are clear that the Biden position of what we might call bear hug diplomacy, where the symbolism of his embrace physically and politically of Netanyahu and the Israeli state is, we have your back, we will protect you no matter what, but please make a few amendments. They have no reason to take that seriously because the U.S. doesn't express it seriously.
I want to turn to U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken, speaking Wednesday in D.C. at a State Department briefing.
I hear virtually no one saying, demanding of Hamas that it stop hiding behind civilians, that it lay down its arms, that it surrendered. This is over tomorrow if Hamas does that. This would have been over a month ago, 6 weeks ago, if Hamas had done that. And how could it be? How can it be that there are no demands made of the aggressor and only demands made of the victim?
Phyllis Bennis, your response.
You know, it's ironic that the Secretary of State of Israel's biggest supporter, the provider of 20% of its entire military budget, among other things, will move forward to say that it's that there's the need for the people of Gaza, because this war is against the people of Gaza. It is not just against Hamas. That's simply not the case. The notion that the U.S. is saying that the demand should be made on Hamas, when it's been the United States backing of Israel that has allowed Israel to impose a siege on Gaza for 17 years, we should be clear, this siege did not begin on October 7th. It was escalated after the atrocities that were committed on October 7th, for sure. But this had been going on for 17 years, harshly enough that 20% of all children in Gaza were stunted by the age of two because they could not get sufficient food necessary for children to thrive. That was way before October 7th. So we have to look at this in the context of the ongoing war that Israel has been waging in Gaza, against the people of Palestine. And it's a war that has become genocidal in its impact. So this notion that Secretary of State Blinken, who is desperately trying to divert the focus of U.S. outrage, global outrage at Israel and at the United States for enabling the Israeli war crimes to continue, he's using every possibility that he can. The negotiations are underway between Israel and Hamas in Cairo, with Egypt and Qatar as interlocutors. There's other negotiations underway, of course, at the United Nations, as we've been discussing. But the bottom line is that Israel has killed 20,000 people, 70% of them, children and women. And that doesn't even count the thousands of people that have been killed under the rubble when Israeli bombs have destroyed buildings and homes over people's bodies. So we're looking at something that has never happened at this scale in this century. And that has to be our focus. That's why we need a ceasefire. You're not going to be able to protect the hostages and bring them home without a ceasefire. You're not going to be able to bring in sufficient aid to make it possible to stop what is now real starvation in Gaza. We have not seen that before, even under the siege. We have not seen actual starvation. And now the United Nations World Food Program is saying that more than half of the families in Gaza are starving and that 90% are food insecure. That doesn't exist anywhere in the world right now, where 50% of a population is starving. And that's what has to stop. And that's why we need a ceasefire to end those realities.
And finally, Phyllis, we just have a minute. If you could respond to the New York Times Siena poll that was released earlier this week, where it's clear that the majority of Americans are opposed to the Biden administration's policy, but in a perplexing finding, a number of them say that they would, in the 2024 election, vote for Trump instead as a result.
I can't explain it. I don't know exactly what the question was that they asked. And that's always a key part of how they get answers like this. But I think what's key is the first thing you said, Nermeen. There is massive opposition in this country to what the Biden administration is doing. 80% of Democrats, President Biden's own party, want a ceasefire now. We're seeing massive opposition within the State Department, within the White House, the White House interns, these young, ambitious students, high school and college students, the youngest of the federal workforce, came out publicly and said, we are not the leaders of today, but we aspire to lead in the future, and we cannot stand by and watch this genocide being perpetuated by Israel with our support. That's extraordinary. That's never been seen before in this country. And that's why we say that not only is the U.S. isolated at the United Nations, but the Biden administration on this issue is massively isolated within the United States itself.
Phyllis Bennis, I want to thank you for being with us, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, international advisor for Jewish Voice for Peace. We'll link to your new piece in These Times, The Christmas Truce of 1914 and the Demand for a Ceasefire in Gaza. Coming up, we look at the Colorado Supreme Court's historic decision to bar Donald Trump from the Colorado primary ballot over his role in the January 6th insurrection, and then his increasingly extreme rhetoric talking about immigrants poisoning the blood of the nation. Back in 20 seconds.
It's just me, myself, and I. 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 Now you tease my plug one style and my plug one spectacle. You say plug one and two are hippies. No, we're not. That's pure plug four. Always pushing that we formed an image.
Me, Myself, and I by De La Soul. Trugoy the Dove, also known as Dave Jalicor, passed away at the age of 54 earlier this year. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Colorado, where the state Supreme Court has ruled in a 4-3 decision to bar Donald Trump from the state's 2024 presidential primary ballot because of his actions during the January 6th insurrection. In an unprecedented decision, the justices ruled that the former president is ineligible to appear on the ballot, citing the insurrection clause of the 14th Amendment, which was written to prevent Civil War Confederates from returning to government. Section 3 of the amendment states, quote, "No person shall hold any office, civil or military, under the United States, who, having previously taken an oath as an officer of the United States to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection," end quote. Trump has vowed to appeal the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, where conservatives hold a 6-3 majority. Meanwhile, a number of other states are also considering barring Trump from the ballot.
We're joined now by the constitutional attorney, John Boniface, president of Free Speech for People, which has filed legal challenges to Trump's eligibility to appear on the ballot in a number of states, including Minnesota, Michigan, and Oregon. First, John, if you can talk about what happened in Colorado and respond to those who simply say, why let the courts decide? Why not let the voters decide? Why remove him from the ballot?
Well, thank you, Amy, for having me. This was a fantastic victory for our democracy and our Constitution. The Colorado Supreme Court got it right. Donald Trump is disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment for inciting, mobilizing, facilitating the insurrection on January 6th. Now, to your question about why not let the voters decide, the fact is that our Constitution makes clear that you have to meet certain qualifications to run for president of the United States. That includes being of 35 years or more by the time of the inauguration, being a natural born citizen, and not having taken an oath to defend and preserve the Constitution and then turned around and engaged in insurrection. And that is what Donald Trump did. He is disqualified under that critical constitutional provision. It's designed to protect our republic. The framers of the 14th Amendment placed it into the 14th Amendment after the Civil War to ensure that those who threaten the republic by taking that oath of office and then turning around and engaging in insurrection shall never hold public office again.
So, John Boniface, could you talk about where else similar decisions may be made? What other states are considering also potentially banning Trump?
Well, first, I want to say we congratulate our allies at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington for their outstanding work in the Colorado case and achieving this victory. And we're proud to have helped catalyze the movement and the work around the country to uphold Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. At Free Speech for People, we have filed similar challenges to Donald Trump's eligibility in Minnesota, in Michigan, and in Oregon. And two of those cases, Michigan and Oregon, are now pending before their state Supreme Courts. Just yesterday, we notified both of those courts via supplemental authority letters of the Colorado decision and making clear of its application to our cases in Michigan and Oregon. And we have been also quite public that we intend to file additional challenges very soon in other key states. The key question here is now, what will the Supreme Court do? Will they take this case, and how will they rule? But I also want to add another critical question is, what will election officials do all across the country? They have the mandate to follow the mandate of the Constitution, to follow what the constitutional requirements are here for placing candidates on the presidential primary ballot. And that includes Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And they now have a state Supreme Court ruling making clear that Donald Trump engaged in insurrection and is disqualified, and they ought to follow that ruling and bar him from their state ballots as well.
I want to read to you a quote from former Biden administration official Tim Wu, who's a professor at Columbia University. He wrote on the platform X, quote, "This may be an unpopular post, but I think we need to realize that using undemocratic means to fight candidate Trump increases the odds of losing democracy itself. I don't mean you should ignore clear-cut violations of the law, for example, accounting fraud in the New York case, but anything that feels like a reach is dangerous," Tim Wu said. If you could respond to that, John, and also the fact that Biden was asked about the Colorado decision on Wednesday, and this was his response.
Is Trump an insurrectionist, sir?
Well, I think it's self-evident. He saw it all. Now, whether the 14th Amendment applies, I'll let the court make that decision. But he certainly supported an insurrection. And no question about it. None. Zero. And he seems to be doubling down on about everything.
So, John, your response to what President Biden said, and then also Columbia Law Professor Tim Wu.
Well, just on Columbia Law Professor Tim Wu, and I admire his work, but I think he's wrong on this matter. This is not an anti-democratic fight in the courts. This is, in fact, a fight to protect our democracy and to protect our Constitution. We cannot ignore what the clear language of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is, and the reasons why the framers of the 14th Amendment placed that into the Constitution. This was right after the Civil War. There were ex-Confederates who sought to remain in power or to attain power, and a clear decision was made by those who drafted the 14th Amendment, by the Congress that passed it and the states that enacted it, that those who take an oath of office to defend our Constitution and then turn around and engage in insurrection, as the Confederates did, are barred from ever holding public office again. They represent a threat to our republic. And now we have the second insurrection in our nation's history on January 6, 2021. Donald Trump incited that insurrection. He mobilized it. He engaged in that insurrection. And he is barred from holding future public office. This is about protecting our democracy. If we ignore this provision of the Constitution, we make it a dead letter, and we set a very dangerous precedent going forward that people can ignore their oath of office and engage in future insurrections. As to President Biden's comments, I think he's absolutely right that Donald Trump has proven to be an insurrectionist, and the courts must uphold Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
John Boniface, I want to thank you so much for being with us, president of Free Speech for People, which has filed legal challenges to Trump's eligibility to appear on the ballot in a number of states, including Minnesota, Michigan, and Oregon. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show looking at Donald Trump's increasing authoritarian rhetoric on the campaign trail. Over the weekend, Trump claimed immigrants are poisoning the blood of the country.
When they let, I think the real number is 15, 16 million people into our country, when they do that, we got a lot of work to do. They're poisoning the blood of our country. That's what they've done. They poison.
Trump's remarks sparked widespread criticism. Vice President Kamala Harris said Trump's words were, quote, similar to the language of Hitler. On Tuesday, Trump doubled down during a campaign stop in Iowa.
It's crazy what's going on. They're ruining our country. And it's true. They're destroying the blood of our country. That's what they're doing. They're destroying our country. They don't like it when I said that. And I never read Mein Kampf. They said, oh, Hitler said that in a much different way.
Trump was standing between two Christmas trees. We're joined right now by Jeff Charlotte, award-winning journalist and author, professor of English and creative writing at Dartmouth College, author of several books, including The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Of course, Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary are the first two for the Republicans. The Democrats have changed their primary schedule. Jeff, first respond to this poisoning of the blood and the comparisons to Adolf Hitler. His wife, Ivana Trump, the mother of his first three children who died falling down the stairs a little while ago, had said that he had a book of quotes of Adolf Hitler on his bedstand. Take it from there, Jeff.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that Trump volunteers. I haven't read Mein Kampf. And in fact, the book he's alleged to have had and seems to pretty certainly have had was a different book of Hitler's. But what's fascinating to me is he's going out of his way to say that and to repeat that language after it's already the comparison's already been made. And I think he's invoking that because it's chaos and it's drama. And I think he's counting that in his base. He's going to be more helped by the high drama of Hitlerian operatics in World War II than the comparison to the worst fascist dictator in history. I don't think he's dodging it. I think he's going toward it.
So what do you think, Jeff, of the consequences of not taking these words of Trump's seriously? And also, you know, is this likely to diminish his support or, in fact, increase it?
I mean, all we need to do is sort of look what's happening. It's increasing the support. Again, he's understanding that drama and spectacle are what he purveys. But in terms of not taking it seriously, I'm glad a lot of the press is still covering this race like it's a horse race as opposed to a last gasp of the closest thing we could, you know, let's hold on to what we have of American democracy. We're starting to look at something called Project 2025. This is a 900-page blueprint put together by Trump's allies, the Heritage Foundation, funded by Koch money. Press has made a lot of Koch about the Kochs endorsing Nikki Haley, but they're covering their bets. A 900-page blueprint for day one. Remember, Trump says, from day one, on day one, I'm going to be a dictator. Which is another bit of language that I think he's kind of rope-a-doping the press. I'm going to be a dictator. I'm just joking. Now, on day one, I'm going to be a dictator. Just joking. What was that word I kept saying? Dictator. Again, it's even more important than the substance is the spectacle, the drama that makes him the exciting, and in fascist terms, the man of action. Then you've got this 900-page document that lays out agency by agency, with every right-wing think tank on board, with the personnel, 20,000 personnel already figured out, recruiting 5,000 lawyers to fight for this, talking about concentration camps, domestic surveillance, all the facets of a full-sized fascist government. He doesn't have to have read that, just like he doesn't have to have read Mein Kampf to hit those notes.
So, in the 2025 document that people should understand, this 30-chapter, as you said, 920-page document funded by the Heritage Foundation, the Koch brothers, talking about defunding the Department of Justice, dismantling the FBI, breaking up the Department of Homeland Security, Departments of Education and Commerce. And your title of your book, the subtitle of The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Can you tease that out as we move into 2024, what you mean by a slow civil war?
Yeah, I think the slow civil war, I mean, first of all, we look at the casualties of that are already happening. People, pregnant people forced to have children or suffering physically, even dying. The epidemic of trans and queer suicide. All these facets of a growing concentration of fascist policy. But the slow civil war also takes place through lawfare, through the laws that prevent people from getting the things they need. There are casualties of that. What we see in that document is the blueprint for a massive acceleration of it. It's an the plan is based around 180 days, and they go back to Heritage Foundation made its name by making a similar document for Ronald Reagan in 1980, 60% of which was implemented within the first 6 months of his administration. They cite that and they say, okay, but that was for Reagan. Now we're in the age of Trump. We need to go much further. That's the term that they actually use, much further.
So, Jeff, how representative would you say this document is to the far-right conservative movement? And do you think, irrespective of whether Trump is elected or not, some of these policies will be carried through, or an attempt will be made to carry them through?
Yeah, I think that's the other thing we have to remember. One, through some fluke of fate, it is, after all, Nikki Haley, a possibility I don't take seriously, but if it does happen, this is ready-made for her as well, but it's also ready-made for right-wing activism. It's putting the stamp of Trumpism, and that's coming not from one group or another that's been taken over, but Heritage Foundation, Alliance for Defending Freedom, which is the group arguably responsible for overturning Roe. We see the Christian right organizations. We see the libertarian big business organizations. We see the intellectuals, as it were, of the right-wing movement, Claremont Institute, Hillsdale College. It's a convergence. The document represents 400 contributors, many, many of them former Trump officials, defense contractors. So I think it's a document also meant to display once and for all the full sort of application of the competence of the wonks put to work for the fury of Trump's fascism, and to sort of say, okay, everybody's on board. This is the shape. This is the project. The project is Trumpism, regardless of where the man is.
Finally, you're in New Hampshire, Jeff. Nikki Haley got the endorsement of the governor there, of Governor Sununu. The significance of this and her response to President Trump talking about the comments about the blood and the polluting of the blood of this country, she said are simply not helpful. If you can end by talking about what this language does and how it shapes the entire discourse and what you think the media needs to do in response.
I've been impressed, actually, that they have stepped up a little bit more than they have been recently with just not just that language, but vermin and this kind of exterminationist language. It's important to remember that poisoning the blood doesn't just come from Mein Kampf, but it runs like a very poisonous undercurrent through American right-wing rhetoric. I'm looking at a document from 1957, a call by the American Mercury, a right-wing publication, for citizens' trials. And it reads like it could have been written yesterday, and it talks about poisoning the blood. This is this kind of low thrum that's always been there. And Trump is now putting it on the national stage, giving it that platform that the far right has always wanted and was just a little bit, I think, afraid to claim. They were worried, if we say this out loud, maybe we'll lose the people. And now they're discovering that the people they want are coming to them because they are naming the F word, fascism, out loud.
Jeff Charlotte, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of English and creative writing at Dartmouth College, author of several books, including The Undertow, Seams from a Slow Civil War. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Teresaina, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, we are
Liars.
I'm Javin, I play keyboards and sing in
Young Pacific. I'm Nathaniel, I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
You are listening.